Good morning, everyone. Today we'll start Ecclesiastes in our study of that book. And by way of preface, I want to say that I've stolen all my ideas from Luther, from this book in the Concordia Commentary series by James Bullhagen on Ecclesiastes, from another little book by Peter Kraft, Three Philosophies of Life, and the first being Ecclesiastes, Life as Vanity. Okay, so if you hear really good ideas, they probably come from one of those three sources. And this way I kind of blanketly absolve myself from plagiarism. The question arises, why study Ecclesiastes? Why on earth would you go back to that Old Testament book, in a book that's notoriously known to be what? Yeah. Pointless, right. Yeah. A book about pointlessness has to ultimately be pointless itself, right? Well, wrong. A book about pointlessness can make the most important of all points. That's the paradoxical nature of Ecclesiastes. It's a book that's notoriously known to be depressing, but I hope that as we study it together, you'll see that it's not depressing. You'll see that it's not a book that leads us to despair as if despair were a place of indignity, a place of wretchedness, but it will lead us to despair in the way of dignity, in the way of honesty, in the way of seeing a thing as it is. Akin to what Luther said, calling an evil thing evil and a good thing good, instead of the way that we do our theology as fallen human beings universally. We call evil good and good evil. Okay, so Ecclesiastes is a dose of sanity and a dose of reality, and for that reason it's not very palatable to modern American Christians. Ecclesiastes asks the most dangerous question that a human being can ask. A question that our culture avoids asking at all costs. So if you want to share the wonderful insights you've learned by studying Ecclesiastes with your friends and family, don't be surprised when they are not having it, when they're not interested, when they roll their eyes, when they think the questions you raise, the questions that Ecclesiastes itself raises, are pointless, meaningless, and not worth looking into. There's a reason for that. Our culture avoids these questions at all costs, and they are nonetheless the most important questions. What is the point, the purpose, the meaning of your life? Of life in general, but of your life in specific. Now, as I mentioned briefly before, and we'll look at this in depth as we go throughout the weeks, our culture of consumerism is meant to keep us so busy that we don't bother asking these questions. Have you seen The Matrix? It's Matrix-esque. Keep us so distracted we don't really even ask the question, what is the reality? Is this reality? What's going on? And that's why Ecclesiastes is a wake-up call. Arguably the most relevant of all the Old Testament books would be the message of Ecclesiastes. Because Ecclesiastes takes soft, consumeristic people, and it holds that idolatry before our eyes in all its wretchedness and all its poverty, and then it rips it away and grabs us by the back of the neck and forces our head to look into the black abyss of existence, which we don't want to do. It's very uncomfortable. Why look into the black abyss of existence when I can look at anything else I want? And so Ecclesiastes is, a shot of whiskey that instead of inebriating us, sobers us. That's what Ecclesiastes is. Ecclesiastes is going to ask you questions, and I hope you meditate on them, because that's the point. What are you living for? What are you living for? And as you think about that question, it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable even if you're a Christian. There's all sorts of layers you have to sift through in yourself when you ask, what am I living for? Are you living for the next iPhone? Maybe not the next iPhone, but maybe, I don't know, whatever it is you're into. Is that what you're living for? Are you living for the next vacation? Is that what you're living for? Are you living for the next weekend? Are you living for the end of the day? Are you living for the glass of wine or beer or whiskey or whatever it is at the end of the night? What are you living for? Are you living for things that would ultimately be distractions? You know, that's the uncomfortable thing about hobbies. As you look into hobbies, as you look into things you're interested in, you can see, and yet if you're like me at least, you intentionally blind yourself to the limitations of those hobbies, right? So you're a young person and you invest yourself in the hobby of basketball. And even as you're doing it, as you're practicing your free throws, as you're going through junior high and then high school, and then there's no longer a team, so you're the rec club superstar, and you see the handwriting on the wall that there's a limit and an end and a meaninglessness to it. And that's true for anything. It's true if you take on a hobby that's like woodworking. You can get better and better and better and only so good depending upon your talents and abilities and time you have to invest in it. And then that's it. And then it decreases and it's left behind. Some people's houses have these things called closets. And you open the closet and instead of like Narnia, it's almost the opposite. You get bombarded with all the ancient skeletons of hobbies that have long since died. Some folks' garages like that. You don't open the garage door ever. Okay. The point being that hobbies have a death to them. So if you are, this is a painful thing to look at, if you are sort of living for this thing you do, albeit on the side, albeit whatever, but it's your passion and you're living for that, are you brave enough to realize that it's a distraction? Are you brave enough to realize its limitations? Are you brave enough to acknowledge that? Those are the questions that Ecclesiastes will ask you to look at. Are you living for a degree? Are you living for a job? And if you're living for a degree, if you're living for a job, what for? What for? So, I don't want any of the college kids in here to go into crisis, so let's do the job thing. Why are you living for your job? Okay. Why are you living for your job? Because what? Well, I'm not hearing. I'm old man already. Because you're hungry, exactly. Yeah, that is cutting to the chase. Because you're hungry. And other people probably in your family are hungry. When they get hungry, it's your problem. That's why you work, is to eat. And why do you eat? To work. If you're living to work, then you work to eat and you eat to work. This is one of the things we'll look at when we look at the first chapter in Ecclesiastes, is the problem with cycles. What we've done is just taken the whole economy of human life and boiled it down to a cycle of two poles, really, working and eating. But you know, you can think about this really elaborately. In fact, this little microcosmic thing of you work to eat and eat to work actually works out to the entire macrocosm of world economy. Peter Kreeft, and I won't do it justice, says, stare at a bridge. Stare at a bridge. Watch the cars going back and forth. Back and forth. Why are the cars going back and forth? Getting people to their jobs. And why are they getting to their jobs? Because they want to eat, right? And so they're getting to their jobs to make money, to eat, to pay other people to do other things that they can't do, like farming, like plumbing, like, right, the whole economic system. And ultimately, that works out to someone who's getting paid by those people via their taxes, perhaps, to build that bridge. And so you're staring at that bridge, and ultimately you conclude the people going back and forth and back and forth are going back and forth on that bridge in order to build that bridge. And once that bridge is built, they go back and forth on it. And then they go back and forth to repair that bridge. And that's all there is. That we will look at in the first chapter as the problem with cycles, that everything cycles, everything is circular, and thus everything is vanity or meaningless. Now, again, the point of this is not to depress you. The point of this is to undelude you. Okay? Because we have been deluded by the world to think it's not that. It's linear. It's going somewhere. There's progress. It makes a difference. It matters. And the wisdom of Solomon, the wisdom of Ecclesiastes, ultimately the wisdom of God himself, says no. And you don't need special revelation to figure that out. You just need honesty. Honesty. That's what's required. Okay, so are you living for your degree? Are you living for your job? Why are you alive? It is a very uncomfortable question. Are you living for your family? Pastor, everything I do is for my kids. What's the point of their life? You see, if life is vanity, and you live your whole life in service to someone else's vanity, then what is your life and your service to that other person? Vanity. You see, so not even this philanthropic, altruistic self-sacrifice in service of another is spared by Ecclesiastes. If you live your whole life in service to others, you live your whole life in service to other people's vanity, which makes your life of service vain, meaningless. Right?
Let me ask you a question, Pastor.
No questions. Can we get a mic for you?
Well, you can hear me. I can speak.
Well, the people on the internet, they want to hear. Absolutely right. In fact, that's where Solomon directs us in the first chapter. He directs us to specifically two things in nature that come right to my mind, wind and water. Wind is tireless. It's always blowing somewhere. Wind is going, 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 always, always, always. It's chaotic. And at the end, what does wind accomplish? Yeah. Moves your boat right out to the middle of the ocean and then stops, and hopefully you've got a motor. The wind is busy, and it's busier than any human being. It's busier than the human race, and it accomplishes nothing. It simply cycles around the globe. We'll look at that. Same with water. Water just cycles around the globe. You know, it evaporates, falls down everywhere except for here, apparently. It goes back up, it goes back down, it flows around the earth, it goes back up, it goes down, and in the end, what did it do? Just a cycle. Just a cycle. So exactly right, Jack. This isn't unique to the human condition. It's unique to the fallen human condition and the entirety of the fallen world. In a word, what we are doing, what Ecclesiastes does, is fleshes out what Paul says in Romans 8 when he says that God has subjected creation to futility, frustration. What we are doing is mapping that out. Solomon is mapping it out for us. And we're tracking with him, and we're pulling off the pious blinders that tell us that everything's okay. And you know, that's the beauty of God's religion, is he erases and destroys false man-made religion. And our biggest false man-made religion is that everything's okay, everything makes sense, everything has a purpose, just don't think about it. just believe it, right? And God says, no. No. Strip the blinders off. Look at the thing for what it is. Now, this is why Ecclesiastes is the question. It's the question. All of Christendom is going around shouting the answer right now. Right? Think about this. Think about it like this. It's a dumb analogy. But imagine if there was a group of people and they canvassed your neighborhood from time to time. They knocked on your door, and as soon as you opened the door, they shook your hand. And they said, hi, you know, I'm so-and-so and so-and-so and four. What? Let's say that you are having coffee with your friend, and your friend's, you know, talking and this, that, and the other thing. You're talking about the power of four in your life and how important four is. And four is just gives you so much comfort. And they're going, four? And yeah, you're like, yeah, four. Four is just where it's at. Well, I'm glad four is working out for you. No, you don't understand. Four is true. I have taken apologetics courses. I can blast your mind away to prove to you that four is true. Four is true. That's okay. I'm glad it's true for you. Maybe it's true for me. I don't know. That's wonderful. Four. Okay. What is the question? You see, we're going around blasting the answer. Jesus. Jesus, Jesus. Four, four. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. And everyone's going, glad Jesus is true, glad he works for you, but he's the answer without a question. It's like shouting four at someone. They don't care until they realize that the question is, what is 2 + 2? And if you don't get it right, the entirety of mathematics falls apart. Right? What is 2 + 2 is four, and that's knowing the question and the answer. Ecclesiastes is the question. You see, and it does us no good when we powder coat the question, when we erase the question because it makes us too uncomfortable, because then with it we erase the answer, or at least the importance, the relevancy of the answer, so that we become people shouting the answer at people when they don't even know what the question is. So Ecclesiastes specializes in answering the question, and that's why we're going to specialize in not stripping the question of its power, right? There's a similar thing Christians do with Good Friday. They can hardly stand to talk about Good Friday for anything more than 30 seconds without talking about what? Easter. Yeah, it's like a disease. We can't wait and dwell and pause on Good Friday. We're always moving on to Easter. And the same would be true with Ecclesiastes. We can't bear the question as it is, so we're always moving on to the answer, to take away the crisis, to take away the issue, to not allow it to stir us up. So with our meditation on Good Friday, with our meditation on Ecclesiastes, we are going to make a point of not neutering it, and of not sugarcoating it, and of not moving on too fast. Okay? So that's why I am going to hesitate, I'm going to resist, I'm going to try to restrain myself from immediately, as we're reading through Ecclesiastes, being like, and this is how Jesus answers it, and this is how Jesus answers it, and this is the hope that we get. Why? Because that's not the point of Ecclesiastes. That's rushing to Easter when there's more to be gained from Good Friday. And so that is, by way of apology, how I'm going to walk us through Ecclesiastes. I'm not going to be pointing out how Jesus fulfills, answers, and takes away the existential burden of these passages without us actually pausing to feel that burden, which is precisely what God intends us to do. Okay, why else study Ecclesiastes? This is a long apology now that I think about it. Maybe this will be the whole class. What other reasons should we study Ecclesiastes? Because it is subversive, because it is an outlawed book, because if the Old Testament canon were being constructed today by American Christians, it would be left out. Why? Because the highest virtue in American Christianity today is happiness. It's the highest virtue. Are you happy? And if you're happy, then you must be doing other stuff right, because God is blessing you with happiness, or he's blessing you with the ability to be happy even when things aren't happy. happiness is the tell-all, is the pinnacle theological virtue. How is your faith? How is your sanctification? How is your walk with God? This can all be determined by one simple question. How happy are you? That's the functioning theology of glory, as Luther would call it, that's alive and well, and in fact has become the central touchstone of theology for American Christianity. Are you happy? And what Ecclesiastes does is picks at that, and picks at that, and picks at that, and asks, is happiness the point? What is happiness? Is happiness just your own personal happiness so that you are happy with yourself and that's happiness? Or does happiness extend to others being happy about you? What about God being happy with you? You see, so the theology of happiness is called into question by Ecclesiastes, who says that, in the first place, happiness isn't as simple as we like to think it is. And we actually know this deep down. We just don't let ourselves know this. Why? It's not pious. It's not Christian. It's not Christian to ask yourself if happiness is the pinnacle, because as we all know, happiness is the pinnacle. So Ecclesiastes is very un-Christian. Ecclesiastes is pure evil. Because Ecclesiastes starts cutting and chipping away at the chief theological virtue, happiness. And it works to erode it, and it works to undercut it, and it works to make you question what happiness is. And if, as the world says, it's all about you, and are you happy, and never mind what other people think, you be you, believe in yourself, be happy with... If all of that is true, then Ecclesiastes is false. If Ecclesiastes is true, then all of that is false. In the words of Simon and Garfunkel, I have my books and my poetry to protect me. I am shielded in my armor, hiding in my room, safe within my womb. I touch no one and no one touches me. I am a rock, I am an island, and a rock feels no pain and an island never cries. And you can hear the irony dripping from those words. Well, Ecclesiastes intends to make you feel pain and intends to make you cry because it intends to make you human. And the prevailing philosophies and theologies of our age dehumanize us. Everyone needs to be happy to be Christian dehumanizes you. Dehumanizes you. All right. What else can we say? Are there any thoughts or questions on the reasons, the rationale, the purpose that we have discussed for studying Ecclesiastes? Okay. As I like to say, I've done a very good job, a very poor job, one of the two. So let's go ahead and look at Ecclesiastes briefly. By way of just the typical introduction, it's written by Solomon. It's written around 931 BC, just before the kingdom split into two, the north and the south. In this, Solomon calls himself the preacher. We'll discuss that as we look at verse 1. And we will see law themes and gospel themes, but again, primarily we're going to see law themes. We're going to see Ecclesiastes ask the questions to which the only answer can come in Jesus. And not Jesus like the pat Sunday school answer, but Jesus three-dimensional and real, Jesus incarnate in human flesh. Because the only way, if Ecclesiastes is the human condition, then the only way to be set free is for God to become man, for God to take this condition upon himself and reverse it. So then we will see with every contour of Ecclesiastes, we will see a portrait of Jesus emerge. in the negative space, if you will, of what Ecclesiastes asks and what Ecclesiastes teaches. Okay. Anyone interested in eisegetical matters beyond that? Me either. Let's get to the text. Okay, chapter 1, verse 1, we're going to do the intro, and then we're going to do cycles. That's how this starts, cycles. Not the kinds you ride. Well, actually, yeah, you do ride them. The words of the preacher, okay, the Hebrew word koheleth, and this is call is like the called ones. It's why it's called Ecclesiastes. You recognize that from ecclesia, the church. The called out ones is what that means. That's what we are as the church. And that in Hebrew, that root is at the root of the word preacher, which is why it's translated as preacher. He's the one who speaks to the called out ones. He's the one who speaks to the church, which would make him a preacher. And so that's why he's called a preacher in English. The words of the preacher, the son of David, again, this is Solomon, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities. Okay. Vanity does not mean vain like the song, "You're So Vain." Right? It doesn't have to do with narcissism or the self turned in on the self. It's not that sort of vanity. It's vanity that it translates to meaninglessness or purposelessness or futility. Meaninglessness of meaninglessness, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. And here in Hebrew it's nuanced. The all is vanity. Your English probably says all is vanity. The Hebrew says the all is vanity. Okay? Here's cycle number one. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Okay, so built into the human race is a cycle. One generation after another generation after another generation after another generation. And each generation, as it goes along, sort of erases the preceding generation. And you could picture it like, you know, as it moves through, it's graying out the previous ones until they're finally grayed into white and forgotten. But it's a cycle that erases the previous slowly and erases it and moves on and moves on, but it cycles. And the futility of that, of course, is that then the human race, generation after generation, isn't progressing, isn't evolving, isn't reaching some peak and pinnacle. We are cycling. We are just repeating. We are growing and dying and growing and dying and growing and dying. We are not like some great evolutionary creature that is going on and carrying on and advancing. We are rather like the flowers of the field. Here today, gone tomorrow. Here today, gone tomorrow. Here today, gone tomorrow. If those flowers are evolving, they're evolving in a microcosmic sort of way. They're evolving in a parallel sort of way. They're not ever becoming other than flowers. If human beings are evolving at all, it's only in a microcosmic way. We're never becoming anything more than humans. And at that, we're never becoming anything more than fallen human beings. And in that sense, we are nothing but a cycle, a repeating cycle. Okay, that's the nature of the human race. So our world that tells us we're evolving as a human race, that we're becoming superhuman, that our technologies are proof of this, right, is biblically here presented as wrong. And the more you think about it, now here's the beauty of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes doesn't require you to be a Christian to agree. Ecclesiastes requires you to use your eyes and your reason. And we're going to get to that in just a minute. His method of theology is accessible to everyone. In Ecclesiastes. You don't have to be a Christian. You don't have to be a person of the faith. You have to have eyes and you have to have reason. And you'll come to the same conclusion. The generations are cycling. We are not evolving. We will never cease to be human. We will never cease to be fallen human beings. To the great puzzlement of all of the progressive people out there who are just sure that this generation will end world hunger. even though it hasn't for how many millennia before. Just sure that this generation will discover utopia, will end death. And all of this looniness is presented to us on the front page of Time magazine. It's in our media. It's put before our eyes. Now, if you think about that, that is the delusion. That is the drink. That is what doesn't allow us to be sober and see reality. It is what makes us comfortably numb. The media is like our drug pushers that exploit us with our own permission. We want the media to tell us lies. We want to believe in an evolutionary theory. We want to believe that there's progress and change, that we are on the cusp of saving the whales, of reversing climate change, that we are on the cusp of ending world hunger, and even on the cusp of reversing death itself. Because if we believe these lies, we won't believe the truth. If we believe these lies, we won't have to deal with the truth. And that's why we supply the media and sustain the media to tell they're our drug pushers. Keep us numb. Keep us numb. Keep us numb. So as a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever, humanity itself is cyclical and futile. Vanity. Ready to move on, or do you have thoughts? Anything to add? By all means, add your wisdom. That's what this is, you know. The wisdom of Solomon and you. Jack, did you?
Don't you think humanity has made some progress?
In what sense?
Whether they live longer, or whether they cure certain things. I mean, there's got to be some plus in humanity.
It's sort of like one disease gets cured and another one pops up, though, isn't it? It's sort of like every generation has their disease, or every several generations has their, and then they're either put away or they're beaten by our technology or something, right? But immediately others crop up. And I think that's the point. And yeah, we live longer, but Ecclesiastes would say, for what good? I see a lot of people in nursing homes who kind of question why they ever wanted to live this long in the first place. We sort of accept it as good to prolong this life. We sort of forget that God's the one that took the tree of life away so that this life wouldn't be prolonged indefinitely. That there's a mercy in the ending of this life. Christians can see that. We're poised to see that because we realize that this life isn't all there is, right? But if you're not a Christian, you're going to cling desperately to whatever shred you have because it's better than the black abyss. So, Jack, I guess my point is, yes, we progress with technology. And as we progress with technology, we progress with problems. As we progress with technology, we progress with technologies we use to destroy ourselves in war. As we progress with medicines, diseases progress and evolve. My doctor growing up, I'd go in there and I'd have a bruise on my knee. And he'd be like, have a Z-Pack. Antibiotics. You know, I'm joking. But it was like that. It was like, you know, oh, have an antibiotic. You know, I've got a sore throat, antibiotic. I tweaked something in my ankle, antibiotic. That's just how it was. Now they don't do that. Now you gotta get your story straight. This is the eighth day, and I am still having these symptoms, and they're worsening. Do you have anything that could help this if it's bacterial? You have to beg for an antibiotic. Why? What's the difference? What's the change? We've learned that there's germ resistance, right? That the bacteria become resistant to the antibiotics. And so what has all our antibiotic technology gotten us? Stronger and stronger germs, right? And that's the point, I think, Jack, of the futility is, yes, with every step forward in progress that we make, right along with us comes our shadow, the evil, the curse, the futility that comes right along with it. And threatens to overtake it.
That was kind This guy, spent 9 months a year trying to make a toaster. He went to go get steel from an iron ore place, and he put it all together. It worked for 30 seconds, and then it blew up, and then he sold it for a whole bunch of money to an art gallery. But the point is that our knowledge is all built on the shoulders of others collectively.
Right.
Can we do any of these things individually? It's kind of like a modern-day Tower of Babel.
Yes. The more evolved and advanced we as a culture and as a people become, the less individually we know and the more worthless individually we become. Can't remember where I first read this, but it was not the idea of the toaster, but the idea of a pencil. Let's pretend you got blasted back 2,000 years. What good would you be to ancient people? You could tell them about airplanes. Could you tell them the first thing about how to build one? And so on down the line, automobiles, cars, freeways, great big buildings, anything that we, modern medicines, could you tell them anything? All the way down to a pencil, could you tell them how to make a pencil? Nope, not a thing. It's this weird paradox, the greater we get collectively as a culture, the more worthless we get individually. It's a strange paradox, but if you observe it, it's true. Whereas you don't have a society that is like this, right? Society is small. The individuals now, all of a sudden, are of immense importance and also of immense knowledge and know how to survive and pass that on to their children. I mean, what do I have to pass on to my children in order to get him to survive? Him or her to survive. An education, this is the way the world works. Try not to get sued. But if you're sort of like all of a sudden stripped of that culture and you're out in the world, hey, this is how you hunt. This is how you find edible plants and don't kill yourself. This is how you cultivate food. We'd all pretty much be, except for maybe Eric Mansour, we'd all pretty much be worthless at this, I think. Right? All right, so the point of that is that it holds our collective sense of development and evolution in check. Because it's a paradox that says the more evolved a culture gets, the less worth anything we as individuals get. Other thoughts? Back to the cycles. All right. Verse 5. I should have said. I think I skipped something. No. I just should have talked about 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Okay, so there's the question. What does man gain? What's the point? What's the purpose? What's the meaning for all that he toils under the sun? Now, under the sun is one of the most important phrases in Ecclesiastes, and it's the way that he does theology. He's not doing theology the way we do theology, by supernatural revelation, by supernatural light, right? We could have, for every last thing we've talked about today, we could have a Christian answer, a Christian response. We could pour hope over the top of it, right? But that is all using a supernatural light. That's not what Ecclesiastes is interested in. He only wants to use natural light, under the sun. Nature, what you see with your flesh and blood eyes, that's how to do this theology. What you see and experience with your senses and your reason that God gave you, and when you use them honestly, okay, then this is the theology you'll get. So under the sun is very important because it's giving us, as we'll see throughout Ecclesiastes, it's giving us his modus, the way he's doing theology. And then toil is important. Because we're going to see 5 different kinds of toil that are suggested by Ecclesiastes. This is a way of sort of topically organizing Ecclesiastes. The first toil or pursuit or way of life or philosophy or thing that describes who you are, okay? The first one is wisdom. Do you live to gain knowledge and understanding and have a deeper perspective? Is wisdom your pursuit and your way? Right? And you don't have to just have one. The other one is pleasure. The next one is pleasure. That's number two. Do you live for pleasure? Never mind wisdom, right? Do you have a PhD? No? Yes? Yes, you do. Okay, you have a PhD. I don't. Guess what? This hamburger tastes just as good to me. So pleasure doesn't necessarily have to subvert wisdom, but it says, look, that is the pursuit. There are folks that pursue pleasure. They're your friends on Facebook who every other post are posting the fabulous meal they just ate. That's the pursuit in the living for pleasure. It's a philosophy. It's a way of life. It just is. That's the second pursuit, and it's one that Solomon actually says, yeah, hey, go for it. There's benefits and advantages. I mean, pleasure is good, right? We're not Puritans. Ah, stop it, taste buds. Stop that sensation of pleasure. No, pleasure is good. God made it. God made things pleasurable. Enjoy. That can be a pursuit unto its own. I don't want to just dress. I want to know how to dress in the finest possible way. I don't want to just know, you know, I want to cultivate myself. I want to cultivate my palate. I want to pursue and understand pleasure and all the myriad gifts that God has given within pleasure. It's not an unintellectual thing. It's not just like, ooh, ooh, me caveman, me want sex and food, right? Not like that. Very sophisticated. Solomon's sophisticated, for crying out loud. So he's going to approach pleasure with a sophistication and a wisdom and an intelligence. That's a pursuit. That's a way. That's a toil, verse 3. That is a toil under the sun. Wisdom, pleasure. Those are two. The next one is greatness. And greatness we'll see come up at the end of this chapter. And greatness involves wealth, okay, because if you are great, you're going to get wealth, and if you want to be great and show your greatness, you're going to need wealth. So greatness is wealth and power, okay? But it's wealth and power not for their own sake, it's for the sake of greatness. You're not Scrooge McDuck that just fills your vat with money and then swims in it, okay? You are Scrooge McDuck that takes your money and pours it out for greatness. And it doesn't just have to be self-interested greatness. It could be the greatness of you. It could be the greatness of something you very much believe in, an organization, a movement, whatever it is. But it's the pursuit of greatness. This, by the way, I think is what about 9 out of 10 of Rick Warren's sermons are. They just are. Be a great human being. Pursue a great cause. Namely this church or the gospel or whatever else, but it's about greatness and it's about him teaching you personally how to toil, how to do this toil, how to live this philosophy called greatness. Okay? The fourth is, and this one is going to tweak our noses. This one is stunning. When we get there, it's kind of like your jaw hits the table and you have to pick it back up. The fourth toil under the sun is altruism, philanthropy. Now, we touched on this briefly. Why do you live? I'm living for my kids. I sacrifice everything I have for my kids. And what are your kids and what are their lives and what's the meaning of their life? I don't have the foggiest idea. Vanity. The all is vanity. Vanity of vanities. Their lives are vanity. So you, though you have deluded yourself, are serving vanity, meaningless. You just pushed it off a generation. Instead of serving your own meaningless existence, you're serving someone else's meaningless existence. And Ecclesiastes points out, there's no difference. In the end, you're serving meaninglessness. All in the same. Okay. So this one tweaks our noses because we would think self-sacrifice, philanthropy, altruism. That's safe ground, right? God's going to let that stand. And in Ecclesiastes, he doesn't. He attacks it. It's a toil under the sun, and it's futile. It's a way. It has its pros and its cons, not unlike wisdom, not unlike pleasure, not unlike greatness. But it's a toil under the sun that ultimately ends in vanity, meaninglessness, which is shocking. Shocking. Because I think many Christians would look and say this is the peak and epitome of Christianity and of sanctification, living for others. And it's sort of a slap in the face when Ecclesiastes comes and says, yeah, and that too is vanity. All right, the fifth, even to get a little more out there, religion. Religion. Ecclesiastes attacks religion. Religion is the path, the toil, the pursuit, the way of life. Okay? And it takes so many forms, doesn't it? You have all the myriad forms of all the religions on the face of the earth. And then within those religions, you have myriad forms, don't you? I mean, even within Christianity, the pursuit of religion could be the pursuit of ethics. I'm going to be as ethical as possible. It could be the pursuit of mysticism. I am going to behold God and the mysteries. I'm going to peer into the darkness. I'm going to do what it takes to plumb the depths. It could take on the form of intellectualism. I'm going to apply my reason and create the theological system and write the dogmatic textbook that lasts the test of time. It can manifest itself in orthodoxy. I am going to be more orthodox than you or anyone else. I mean, I'll kowtow to Luther a little bit, but, you know, in heaven we'll be at the same table. That's the pursuit. These are all pursuits of religion, okay? And they're not left unscathed by Ecclesiastes. He doesn't reject any one of these five pursuits like a priori or totally or say they're worthless, don't do them. In fact, it's sort of the opposite message. Do whichever you like, but realize, don't become an idolater to it. Realize that it too is meaningless. And that's a hard pill to swallow. So, when he says in verse 3, what does a man gain by all the toil by which he toils under the sun? We're going to see Solomon progress through these five and cycle back to them, refer to them. Again, it's sort of a topical organization of the content here. Questions or comments on the five toils? Okay, so then let's go back to cycles. We did the generation cycle, the human cycle. Now let's look at nature, the sun itself. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. Up, down, up, down, up, down, up. For how long? A lot longer than we'll be around. Nature itself is futile. The sun goes up, the sun goes down, it never progresses. Never gets better. It never changes. It never becomes new. The sun doesn't come up one morning and you're like, wow, it's in itself, it's just neon green right now. No, it's just the sun. It just goes up and down. You don't say, well, look at the sun. It's swirling this way today. No, it just goes up and down, up and down. The sun rises and the sun goes down. And we might apply this to our lives and call it what? The daily grind. Have you ever thought how depressing it is if you took the week away? The structure of the week that God created, you know, in Genesis. If you took the structure of the week away, you just had days. Up, down, up. You take the structure of the month away too, you know. Up, down. How would you count your life? There's no weeks, there's no months, there's no years, there's just an endless stream of days. There's no order that says, oh, today's Monday, I should be grumpy. Today's Sunday, I get to go to church. There's no flavor. It's just up, down, up, down. The sun, you go with the sun if you're lucky, and if you have kids, you don't. Because kids are unnatural, they're against nature, don't get me started. They're contrary to nature. It's dark. Do you know what that's for? Close your eyes. It's still dark. Don't open them and don't get up right now. All right. So the up down of days is endless. It's the daily grind is how we experience it. And again, if you have eyes to see, you're willing to start knocking the crutches out. Right? The crutch of the week, the crutch of the month, the crutch of the year, the crutch of all the orders and moods and stuff that we lay on top of it. Why? For sanity's sake. If you take all that away and allow yourself to be Ecclesiastes insane for a minute, you go, oh my. Because Ecclesiastes takes you by the back of the neck and shoves your face in the abyss, the hole, the question, right? That we're all afraid and scared to death of to look at, so we pile up all this other stuff on it. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. I think we have time for one more. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. So again, we touched on this briefly. The wind, it's busy as anything else. It's always blowing. It's constantly going. Where's it going? Well, it's going to the south. Whoops, now it's coming around to the north. Now it's just constantly blowing. And if you sit someplace quiet outside of the noise of your iPhone, leave it somewhere, outside of the noise and rush of the freeway, outside of the noise of the television, outside of the noise of your own thoughts, and you sit, and you sit, and you sit, and you sit until you actually see what's in front of you. And you see nature, and you hear the wind, and you see the trees moving, and you watch, and you ask, what is the point? What is the purpose? And the wind answers. The wind goes to the south, then to the north. It goes round and around. In its circuit, the wind returns. And the wind is preaching to you. It's all a cycle. I was here long before you were here. I'm here now in this brief blink you call your life, and I'll be here long after you're gone. And what will I be doing? Absolutely nothing. Going here and there and everywhere, la 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 la, meaninglessness. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, the all is vanity. Humanity teaches you this, nature teaches you this. Now this is the big black hole and abyss. This is the beginnings of the question. The beginnings of the question that is meant to drive you mad. Because when you're mad, you realize that you need. That you need, you need, you need desperately meaning, order, it to all matter. You need it to all somehow be reversed and redeemed. You need a God who comes into this black hole where we are and redeems us and turns the black hole inside out and shines his unnatural light into it. So as we've painted the picture, as Ecclesiastes has painted this picture for us, the question is being asked, and the answer is going to be Christ. God who comes into this, God who takes this upon himself, God who bears all of this futility and blackness and darkness into his own flesh and carries it into the ultimate blackness and darkness of his own tomb, and comes forth on Easter and begins to make all things new. Okay? It's only then that we can look back and look and say generation after generation after generation, but some of those folks are becoming Christian. Some of those folks will live in eternity with God. The sun rises and the sun goes down, and the sun rises and the sun goes down. Instead of meaningless, we see that creation itself is preaching to us the death and resurrection of Jesus. Every day is encapsulated in the death and resurrection of Jesus, as every day is defined and encapsulated by the dying of the sun and the rising of the sun. As the wind blows round and round, no one knows where it goes, where it comes from, what it does. Jesus says, so is the Holy Spirit. So is the work of my Spirit. But it is accomplishing. You may not see it with your eyes, you may not experience it, but my purpose, my will, through my Holy Spirit, is being accomplished. The word of Christ is being preached, and men are leaving the darkness that Ecclesiastes so rightly describes and are becoming children of light. You see, Christ is the answer, and not just in a one-dimensional way, in a profoundly three-dimensional way, he's the answer. But in order to really grasp that, we have to look at the question. Hope you'll join me next week as we continue to study that. The Lord be with you.